Okay, we're on. So today's topic is faith and virtue in modern society. And you'll understand as we go along kind of what that is and what exactly we're talking about. I want to mention just before we begin, I turned the recorder off last week before I mentioned the books that I recommended. And at the end, I'm going to recommend more books, of course. But I want you to understand these books are not like necessities. They're not requirements for you. It's just if you want to learn more about this, these are good references to go to. In all, with the four books that I mentioned last week, and I'll mention them again today, and then three books that I'll mention at the end today, you have seven books. It's really not that bad. You could finish those easily within a year. You could finish those in 6 months pretty easily. But are they necessary? No. I had a couple people say, "Father, I don't know if I can really like understand everything in these books." And I said, "Well, it's fine. I mean, the whole purpose is not to tell you have to do this. It's rather if you want to go get more information. But the whole point of these talks is hopefully we are giving you the information that you then don't have to go investigate yourself. And I'll talk more about that at the end because it's actually not good to get too involved in this stuff. It actually can be a little bit dangerous for you. You can begin to over-intellectualize, and it can really engender a lot of pride because you start to look at things and think, well, I have some special knowledge that other people don't know. I know what's going on. We want to give you what's necessary to understand what's happening, and then we're going to get to the really practical stuff starting next week about how we deal with this. And learning about it constantly intellectually isn't the best way to go. But if you want a really solid foundation, you can go with the books I recommended. So last week we mentioned four books. One was kind of an aside that I just found along the way. The first is A Conflict of Visions, which is by the great economist Thomas Sowell. We're going to revisit him a lot today. The next one was Our Culture, What's Left of It, by Theodore Dalrymple. His real name is Anthony Daniels, but he writes under the name Theodore Dalrymple. And the third one was The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, Haidt. The fourth one that I kind of just came along, I was going through my books, and I read this, I think I mentioned last week, I read this over 20 years ago. But I remember it really addressed some of the stuff we talked about. Well, it was called Slouching Towards Gomorrah by Judge Robert Bork. And so there's an optional fourth one. So, as I said, we're going to add three more at the end of today's talk. So, little recap. Last week, we covered what ideology is. If you remember, we talked about worldviews. We all have worldviews. You can't escape a worldview. And part of the goal of the church is to shape our worldview by first shaping our hearts. We shape our hearts towards Christ, and then we begin to think in the proper ways such that we take every thought captive. Everything we do to see the world, the way that we view the world is the way that God gives us. He gives us new eyes, essentially, to view the world the proper way. But what happens when you have a worldview that you then dogmatize and assert on others, we would call that an ideology. And we talked a lot about how even Christianity itself can become ideological. It's a big danger. We want to watch out for that. We want to watch out for standing in the faith in such a way that we always have to be right, and being right is the most important thing. No, humility and love are more important than always being right. And this is why we don't have a moralistic faith. The fathers sometimes would tell a lie if it meant that righteousness could be pushed forward. So we don't have a moralistic faith, and it's not always about being right. It's about living in holiness and being righteous. And that's a different thing. So we talked about what ideology is, and we talked about how ideology forms mass movements. Not every mass movement is ideological, but the ones that are can be rather dangerous. And we looked at various characteristics of ideologically driven mass movements. That's what we spent the bulk of our time on last week. So today we're going to continue to look at today's ideologically driven mass movements. And that's currently mainly found in the BLM, the Black Lives Matter movement, although there are many movements that contain the same ideology. And we'll talk a great deal about what those who lead the movement hope in and what they value as virtues. What do they consider to be virtuous? And how do they embody those virtues? Before we get to that, there's a question that we had last week, and I wanted to answer it a little bit more in depth because I had to really think about it. The question was, what causes a mass movement to finally end? It was a good question. And really, there are only two answers that I could come up with. The first is that there's a massive shift in national attitude. And that is usually gained only through, what do you think? What do you think causes a massive shift in kind of a national attitude? Usually suffering. We go through a war or a famine, something. That can actually spur on the movement, but if it's deep enough, sometimes people become more rooted. They stop thinking of all these ideas that are floating up in the air about how the way things should be, and they get closer to their families. They get more rooted to the earth and growing things and everything around them and their neighbors, and suddenly everything becomes local again. And we stop this massive movement of trying to change everybody around us because we're just trying to survive together. That's one way. The other way is it doesn't. The mass movement doesn't change, doesn't end. It's just that it grows into various forms. It grows and wanes, but the ideology is continually pushed again and again. And each time it gets more and more ingrained into society. This is exactly what we've seen around us. Because we've talked about a lot of the movements we've seen in the past 10 years, right? We had the Pride Parades, Occupy Wall Street, the Women's March, the big transgender push that we've seen, the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. And if you notice that underneath them all is the same ideological pushes. It's the same stuff. And so people will grow tired of a particular movement of an ideology, but the ideology continues to be pushed again and again and again. Now, some of these movements have rather admirable goals outwardly, right? So usually the goals that are openly stated and are rather vague can be admirable, such as we want to end racism. Okay, well, no one's against ending racism. We want to fight rape and misogyny. Great. We want to fight fascism, etc. But what we really want to find out are the unspoken things of the movements. What are the ultimate goals? That's where we talk about the ideology. We've been talking about that. And the inward mission underlying those goals. Those are what's most important. And a lot of times, the things that underlie the movement cause a lot of contradictions. They cause a lot of contradictions. So what are we talking about? Remember what we said about truth last week? We said that the movement becomes truth itself. Outside logic and outside facts, outside rationality, are not allowed. They are ideological heresy. You do not bring up facts that show that the movement is wrong in what it believes. The ideology and the movement itself are the new truth. And that's why they don't really care when there are contradictions within their own movement. Because the question is does it push forward the ideology? If it does, they're going to use it. So what are some of the contradictions we see around us today? Here's just a few of them. Gender. What are we told about gender? Gender is a social construct. There's no such thing as gender deep down. Gender is just a social construct. There's an infinite number of genders. However, in order to defend transgenderism, you can have the brain of the opposite sex. You can be a man with a woman's brain, even though gender doesn't really exist. It's a social construct. So which is it? Is it a social construct or is it a biological fact? It depends on what argument you're making that day. Here's one that you're very familiar with. Tolerance. Tolerance is the highest value. But we certainly can't allow people with opposing views to speak on college campuses. We have to shut them down. Do we have tolerance for other ideas? Absolutely not. How about this one? You guys don't need the Second Amendment. You don't need guns. We have the police to protect us. The police are the ones that should have the guns. However, the police are also oppressive and they need to be dismantled. Have we heard both in the past year? Absolutely. This is one of my favorites. If you have a corporate board, the only way that the corporate board is legitimate is if it has an equal number of men and women. Because they bring different ideas and different perspectives, and that's really important. And also, children don't need a mother and a father. Two fathers, that's fine. Two mothers, that's fine. I mean, men and women are the same, so what does it matter? And then there's my favorite of all. A little group you may have heard of called Antifa. Antifa. Anti-fascists. And what do the anti-fascists do? They use every single tactic that they call fascism to push forward their cause. Somebody said to me once, they said, how can you be against Antifa? How could you be? They're anti-fascist. Are you pro-fascist? And I said, okay, well, I'm going to start a movement. I'm going to start a new political party. And the political party will be called the everyone will be happy when I win party. How could you be against me? Everyone's going to be happy when I win. I mean, come on, when I win, everyone's happy. It's right there in the name of the movement. Obviously, the name doesn't really mean much. It's what the inner beliefs are and what the tactics are. So you can call yourself Antifa, but that doesn't really mean much if you put on masks, hide your faces, and go beat people who disagree with you. If you block streets, and if somebody tries to get around you, you scream at them that they're racist, point guns at their faces, which is what happened in Payson, or shatter their windows, or try to drag them out and beat them, which is what happened in Portland. It's ridiculous. So the point is that a lot of what you're going to hear and a lot of what you heard last week doesn't make sense, but it doesn't need to make sense. It's not the point. In the ideologue's view, they don't need sense in what they're pushing. They just need to push. And they will push at by any means necessary. So all of that is just to act as an introduction to what we're going to talk about today. We've got a lot to cover. Number one, we're going to talk a little bit more about some things I didn't get to include last week about the left-right divide and how there's a really different perspective I want to give you on that. And that's the part that's going to make a lot of people mad, but that's fun. So, number two, we're going to look at the Marxist roots of today's ideological movement. There's really one thing that they take from Marx's view of history and economics that's really important that will help you understand the movement. Number three, we're going to give a very, very brief view, overview of passions and virtues from Orthodox spirituality with a beautiful quote from St. Nectarius. Absolutely incredible, explains everything in a very short form. Then we're going to look at the opposing virtues that you find in today's mass movements and what the ideologues of today really value. Fifth, we're going to look at the issue of justice and two ways of approaching it. And this and the last one are really going to take the bulk of today's talk. We're going to talk really briefly about the role of faith in movements and the faith in the movements today. And then finally, a really quick word on what we do with all this information. Of course, the rest of the lectures will cover that, but we'll just have a quick word on that at the end. So there's a lot to talk about. We'll just jump right in. So last week we talked a lot about the nature of today's mass movements based on really what's a secularist leftist ideology. Okay? And the common thing to do, you've probably seen this, maybe you've done this yourself, is to say, okay, yes, these things are happening in the left, but, I mean, the right has its problems too. The right has its ideologues too. And we'd say, well, I mean, that's true. Certainly you can find ideologues on the right. But there's this odd thing where we try to always find equal blame on both sides. I don't know, the last time the right had a mass movement, it was the Tea Party, and I don't remember them burning cities down. So there is a difference, and we have to be able to acknowledge that. This is not about being tolerant and fair to both sides. So here's the really odd thing. What's often labeled extremist right movements, and you know the types of things that are called extremist right movements, they're often just one aspect of political thinking on the right that is held up and pushed to the exclusion of all others. It's not really an all-encompassing right movement. In fact, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll take a lot of the ideas of the left, but then wrap it in one idea from the right and combine them together. And they'll twist it in one way or another. So let me explain what I mean by this. A lot of times you hear that an extreme movement on the right is fascism. Fascism is an extremist right position. First problem with this is that most people can't define fascism if they tried. And the word fascism has come to mean a lot of different things. The true economic fascism that it was originally meant to be is not really what we mean today. Today, you know, if you believe in police, you're called a fascist. So it's really lost a lot of its meaning. But usually when people say fascist, what they really mean is you're a Nazi. You're a Nazi. Here's the problem. Hitler's Nazism, if you look at what he actually believed and what his politics actually pushed and his economics actually pushed, there's almost nothing in common with today's American right. Except for one thing, a belief in nationalism, and he used that and he twisted it. There's very, very little in common. And yet it's still called an extremist right movement. The interesting thing was Hitler ran a party that was called the what? National Socialist Party. Kind of interesting. What was the other major fascist movement besides Nazism? What was the other big fascist movement? Italian. Mussolini. Do you know who loved Mussolini? FDR's cabinet. I don't know if you know this. You probably don't know this. They highly praised Mussolini and his economic policies, and they modeled the New Deal after him. Did you know that? Not taught in most history books. Not taught in most history books. So would we consider that a right movement? Probably not. Probably not. People say today that white supremacists are extremists on the right. But the foundation of their ideology is usually a victimhood. And victimhood, the claim of being oppressed, is something we're going to see is the foundation of leftist ideology. And so there's a big mix here. We have to be cautious about what we're talking about. I'll tell you what I really believe about this. When we say that there's a right-left divide, where they lie on opposing sides of the spectrum, there's a horizontal spectrum that we're talking about, I think it's a completely incorrect model. I think it's the wrong model. I think we're looking at it the wrong way. At least in America. We're talking about American politics here because that's what this talk is about, right? What's happening in the American left. Look at the country's founding. Look at the country's founding. All of the fear that the founders had was aimed in only one direction: too much government. They weren't too afraid that the country would naturally push towards too little government. They understood that if you had a government, the government is going to pass laws. And as the government passes more laws, the government gets more power, and it grows and grows and grows. They tried to make the government as little as possible with the Articles of Confederation. That didn't work out too well. They said we have to strengthen the federal government a little bit, but let's make it as minimal as possible. Why? Because within democracy, there is a natural temptation for tyranny. Again, I told you this is the part that's going to make people mad. Let me explain why there's a natural temptation towards tyranny. And a brief explanation. Liberal democracy, when I say liberal, I don't mean American right or left, I mean based in freedom. The old definition of liberalism. Liberal democracy tends towards two things: a desire for outward progress and the danger of mob rule based in theft and selfishness. These are the things that it tends towards. So let me say a couple things about the first, the desire for progress. The progress we seek is outward. We talked a lot about that last week, right? A lot of the topic was about progress. There's outward progress that we always seek because we have a capitalist system. So it's technological advancement that we want. We seek to do things better and more efficiently. And if you're going to run a business, the way you succeed is by running it better and more efficiently with a better product in the end than the guy next to you. That's the nature of capitalism, right? People constantly seeking to outdo one another by making a better product or offering a better service at less cost to themselves. Okay, and there's nothing really inherently wrong with that, by the way. That's just the nature of capitalism, and that's why we see innovation all around us. Everyone's trying to think of new and better ways to do things. Okay? But there's a seed of danger in this. We begin to see everything that's not shiny and new as old and outdated. And this thinking does not remain connected only to objects. We see ourselves as constantly advancing. We're becoming a more advanced people. Look at all the technological advancements we have. Look at what we're able to do that old civilizations could never have dreamed of doing. So we think that we ourselves are advancing as our technology advances. And so we begin to rid ourselves of old, dusty objects. But also old, dusty philosophies, old, dusty ideas, and even old, dusty moralities. We begin to think that we need to advance past everything that's old. And we begin to think that progress is moving past everything that came before us. You hear this phrase all the time, right? Look at the issue of gay marriage and transgenderism. You want to have the right opinions about gay marriage and transgenderism. Why? Because you want to be on the right side of history. Politicians use that language all the time. We can't be on the wrong side of history here. It's this idea that we're always progressing, and there's always a movement forwards towards greater newness in everything that we do. And this starts to explain why when we tear down statues because they were slave owners, we also tear down statues of abolitionists, of people who tried to get rid of slavery. Even those aren't acceptable. Why? Well, they may have fought for the right thing, but that's old. We're done with that. That's part of our history. We've moved past that. We're greater than that. Even the people who believe what we think is right, they're gone. We need to tear down all statues. By the way, a little aside here, we need to understand how novel this idea is. Only in liberal democracy and Marxism is there a sense of constant movement and progress in history, and aiming for some earthly utopia of some sort. Nations before us were more concerned with how to live, how to survive, and how maybe even to thrive, but not for the sake of this world. And this is why having a deeper purpose, which we typically find in God, is so important. We know what we're living for. And this is why monarchy and empires had religious language as being natural to them. Even non-Christian ones. You look at the pagan Roman Empire, before it was Christianized, what did they say about the emperor? He was a demigod. He was almost partly godlike. And they honored him with the same rituals they would use in pagan ceremonies they would offer the emperor. That religious sensibility was always there. Liberal democracies sees the architects of our lives and futures, the architects of our very purpose, as ourselves. We are the ones who are guiding history. We're the ones seeking progress. So it naturally tends towards secularism. Liberal democracies naturally tend towards secularism. But the point is that the idea of constant progress through history, as we understand it today, is not one that the vast majority of nations and peoples throughout history would have understood. It's not really what they would have understood. This is pretty novel for us. So getting back, we've talked about liberal democracy's desire for progress. Within that is the second factor we mentioned, mob rule based in theft and selfishness. Simply put, we can vote ourselves other people's money. And we can vote ourselves more power over our smaller opponents. And in this, we lose a sense of personal responsibility because we begin to think that it's other people's job to take care of us. If someone is living far better than us, well, that's not fair. We talked a lot about that last week, right? It's not fair. Regardless of how much they've worked or how little we have. If we can get enough people to think it's not fair that a small percentage is so much richer than us, then they can start using that power of government to vote themselves their money. And we see that all the time, right? With this idea of redistribution of wealth. And so the founders recognized this. They recognized this was a very, very powerful tool that could be used. And the majority could begin to tyrannize themselves over the minority. And so what do? They sought protection against this. They didn't believe in a direct democracy. Anybody who says that America is a democracy, and if they literally mean it that way, they don't really understand. We're not a democracy. We're a democratic republic. It's a different thing. Part of the reason for that is the founders wanted to protect us against these tendencies. They put in checks and balances in the federal government. They believed in keeping governance local whenever possible. They believed in minority protections, so that if a party was voted the majority in the Congress, they didn't have all the power. They believed in making laws difficult to pass. Why? Because that would keep tyranny's encroachment slow. The government couldn't grow too quickly, and the whims of the people, which are often based in passions and sin, couldn't change the direction of the country too quickly. They wanted things to be slow so we had a lot of time to think about things before we made a change. Do we see that much today? No. And what's happened is that the secularists have found ways around these things. We could talk about a lot of them, but what's one of the main ways we get around when we can't pass the laws that we want? And we can't make people do what we want them to do. What do? We legislate in a different way, from the judicial bench. That's one of the ways we found around it. And if that's not working, we'll instill terror in people. And we say, you better believe what we believe and support us, or we're going to go after your business. Guy wants to hold up his principles and not bake a cake, we're going to sue you. And if you win that, we're going to sue you again. And you win that, we're going to sue you again. And in the middle of that, we might threaten your family and threaten your life and stand outside your house. We may do all these different things. Because we're going to push you to accept what we believe. It's the very mob mentality that the founders fought against. But there was one main protection that the founders believed in. There was one thing that we needed to make this work. If a liberal democracy was going to work properly, we needed this. And without it, it's all going to crumble. What do we need? Not just free speech. That's a great tool, but there's something underlying it. The famous quote of John Adams. Who knows it? Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Let me repeat it. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. That's John Adams. Our founders understood this. They understood things very differently than we understand them, by the way. I don't know if you're aware of this. You know, this idea of like the separation of church and state, which is not a constitutional idea, not in the way that they mean it today. Do you know who pushed forward the first publication of an English Bible in the United States? Congress. The United States Congress is what approved the first publication. They didn't see any problem with that. That wasn't forcing religion on anybody. It wasn't saying you could or couldn't practice your religion, but they believed that the Christian basis for the founding of this country was necessary if this is going to work. Now, one of the things we're not going to talk about, again, controversial statement time. I don't think any of you will have a problem with it, but controversial statement time. We're not going to talk about how the seeds of atheism are actually found within Protestantism itself. So the Christianity they were pushing was a little bit off, and it caused a lot of problems. That's a whole other very, very long discussion. We're not going to get into it, but I do want to mention that the seeds were there from the start, and they couldn't quite see that. But either way, let's get back to this. I told you, I think the whole left-right divide is the wrong way to go. I think this idea of them on a horizontal line, and you're somewhere on that spectrum, I think that's the wrong perspective for this. It's not a left-right divide in my mind. Rather, it was those who, based in morality and religion, believed in personal responsibility, believed in caring for one another on a local, individual level, and desired to keep the government small and unintrusive. And then there are those who slowly became secularized and sought large government through ideology. It's not a spectrum with two sides in my mind. Rather, it's a vertical line. A bottom-up spectrum with personal freedom and responsibility found through morality and religion at the bottom and tyranny at the top. And there's this constant movement towards tyranny. This is why I don't accept this idea when people say, well, that happens on the right too. It may, but what's the ultimate goal here? We have to talk about the ultimate goal. Is the ultimate goal towards more personal responsibility so that we can care for one another? Or is the goal for us to fix every problem at a governmental level when they're really not very good at it and give them more and more power? Okay, having said this, I'm sure, maybe not you, but there are people who will be listening to this recording and they'll be saying, this guy's a nutcase saying all this stuff. You can disagree with me. You can totally disagree with me. This is why I'm giving this in a lecture and not a homily. I wouldn't give this in a homily. This is my personal view. This is not from the scriptures, not from the fathers. This is how I've learned to view this based on all the studying I've done. Okay? It's my own theory based on observations and years of study. But it is clear that if we do not believe in a God-ordained monarchy, then absent a moral and religious people who are willing to take other people's well-being as their own responsibility, the government will step in. And we tend towards a secular tyranny instead. In a religious monarchy, the monarch is always judged by God. So he has someone to be accountable to. But in a secular tyranny, the monarch is judged by no one. This is why we have to be cautious about what we're moving towards. We see that in the Soviet Union, by the way. I was listening to a, or maybe it was one of the books I was reading from Thomas Sowell, and he was talking about how Lenin had all these ideas about how farms ought to be run and how farmers ought to act as good citizens, but he never stepped foot on a farm. What he thought was the most important is what he ran things by. It wasn't from personal experience, and it wasn't based on what they thought, who were actually having their hands in the dirt. So, even if you disagree with my division here, even if you disagree with my system, I'm the speaker, so I'm going to use it anyway. And I'm not going to talk about left and right here. Rather, I'm going to use these two terms. One I got from Thomas Sowell, that's anointed. Those who believe in a large government, those who are pushing this ideology that we see around us, they are the anointed. They're the ones who believe that they know how society should be run, and whether you agree or not, they're going to push it on you. And then I'm going to call what we would consider the right usually, I'm going to call them the guardians. I know that puts a little bit of a positive spin on it. I didn't mean to do this, just the way it is. But the guardians, with the sense of the guardians want to preserve the original ideas that this country was founded on. They want to preserve that religious spirit underneath everything, that morality within the country and personal responsibility. Now, the guardians don't necessarily, this is the common objection here, is if you're a guardian, if you're on the right and you believe that the way things were done at the beginning were better than they're done now, well then you must believe that we should have slavery again. No. Being a guardian doesn't mean that you don't believe that progress is a good thing ever. It's not that, but it's rather that the values that were most inherent to the country's founding are kept. So was slavery an inherent value of the country's founding? No, look at the founders. Look what they say. Many of them were like, we really want to get rid of this, but we know the whole thing will crumble and we'll just end up in a big fight if we try to get rid of this now. So we're hoping this just kind of goes away after a little bit of time. They were prophetic. They're right. It ended in a fight. That's what happened. So it has nothing to do with saying that even the country's sins should be preserved. No, of course not. It's rather saying that the moral, the religious, and the standards of personal responsibility, those foundations of the country, ought to be preserved and guarded as best we can. And that means not giving the responsibility of everything that we don't want to do to somebody else in the government. So, to kind of explain this, there's a question that I've asked some of my leftist friends. I do have some. And one of the questions I ask is this. Just to give you an idea of this vertical line and constantly going up and up towards tyranny, I like to ask him, let's imagine a world in which technology stood at a standstill, okay? There are no new technologies. We're gonna live the way we are now. We're gonna live like this for the next 100 years, okay? Can you imagine a time in which the government comes up with the perfect amount and combination of laws such that they would never have to create a new one? Can you imagine that scenario? And deep down, the answer is no. No, there's always going to be new laws to create. There's always going to be new things to control. There's always something wrong. You can't make that utopia. Because the utopia isn't possible in this world, we constantly strive towards it. And because the job of the government is to strive towards that utopia by controlling society, you have to constantly give them more and more authority to create more laws and gain more power. There's always more to fix. There's always more people to legislate. There's always more power and control to gain. It's a little thought experiment to illustrate this. So to those seeking such control today, what undergirds their views? We talked about their ideology a little bit last week, but there's one thing we didn't mention. There's one overarching characteristic that is probably more important than all others. And that's that the foundation of the secularist left ideology today is based in Marxism. It's based in Marxism. There's one aspect of Marxism that they take above all others. The idea that all of history and all of mankind can be separated into just two categories. Anybody know what those two categories are? Yeah. Marx talked a lot about orthodox versus non-orthodox. That's all he was obsessed about. No, wrong. 0 points, F. Who said that one? Oppressed and oppressors. This is one of the most dangerous things, by the way, is to try to take one paradigm and try to define all of history by it. I'm going to take the feminist perspective and look at everything from the issue of patriarchy. No, people are too complex. History is way too complex. You can't take one idea and explain everything. It doesn't work. It's ridiculous that we try to do it, and yet we accept that all the time. We constantly accept that viewpoint. It doesn't make any sense. But Marx did this. He said everything can be looked at from the oppressed and the oppressors. And all of history can be seen through this lens. This is why the people involved in this movement, they don't have a very nuanced view of things. You notice they're not really grateful to the good things that the country has done. I said to somebody recently, I said, you know, do you have any gratitude at all for anything this country has done? This country has, I mean, we literally fought a war and had a civil rights movement to fix the problems of the past. Like, this is a country that looks at its past and tries really hard to fix the problems and sins. This is a country that has made it normal to own a microwave, air conditioning, a TV, and a car. Go back a few hundred years, and they would have looked at you, like, if you told them what those things were about, they would have been like, my goodness, if you have those in the future, you must be the emperor of the world. Because that's the only way possible that you could have all that stuff. No, we have people who are literally under the poverty line who have those things. Is there any gratitude? No. You can't have gratitude. There's only resentment. But during the riots outside of the church, one guy was yelling something, I forget what, and I was trying not to get involved because, you know, you want to keep yourself safe, but I couldn't help it. He started yelling about how all minorities here are oppressed, and it's just, there's no worse place in the world to be than America if you're a minority. I said, do you really believe that? He said, yes. And I said, can you answer a question for me? He said, sure. I said, why is it that we have a net increase of minority immigrants every year rather than decrease? Yeah. And he went, and then he just stood with his mouth open, and I said, okay, and I walked away. This is the worst place in the world, and yet people want to come here? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. So, we're going to change gears here for a second. It's necessary to understand a little bit about the orthodox view of virtues before we move on. Frankly, we're doing poorly on time, but not as poorly as I thought. When we talk about the virtues in the Orthodox Church, we have to understand what passions are. Passions, what the West called vices. Passions are sins that are ingrained and implanted in your heart and have deep roots. And they become the normal way that you live. And we have to kind of change this. And so we don't seek to abolish the passions. A more nuanced and proper language is we seek to transform the passions. So, anger transforms to meekness. Gluttony transforms into self-control. So St. John Cassian, incredible father of the church, he wrote about the eight principal passions. These are the ones where any sin you can find will be rooted to one of these eight areas. Number one is gluttony. Number two is fornication. Number three is avarice, greed. Number four is anger. Number five and number six are pretty connected. Number five is sorrow or despair. And number six is what's called acedia, or in the Greek, akidia, which means a despondency or a listlessness. That sense in the middle of the day when you know you should pray, but you just move from one thing to another, and you're constantly distracted. Number seven is vainglory, to want others to view you well all the time, to want other people's praise. And number eight is pride. The root of everything, really, is pride. So there's an Orthodox method of healing. We've already talked a little bit about it, but I told you I want to read to you this beautiful quote. It's a little lengthy. It's from St. Nectarius, the wonder of Ravagina, who reposed in 1920. He wrote it to his spiritual child, who's a great elder, Elder Philotheos Zervakos. And this is what he wrote. My dear spiritual child in the Lord, our holy fathers have told us that each sin, whether great and deadly or small and pardonable, is defeated by the opposite corresponding virtue, that is, envy, is defeated by love, pride by humility, avarice by poverty, greed and hard-heartedness by charity and compassion, negligence by diligence, gluttony and servitude to the stomach by fasting and restraint, idle talk by silence, criticism and slander by self-reproach and prayer, lewdness, fornication, adultery, and other sins of the flesh by remembrance of death, the last judgment to come, and the recompense of hell. In general, every evil is defeated by every virtue. As the prophet David says, turn away from evil and do good. If you wish to be delivered also from the sin of pride, the mother and cause of all sins and evil, you will be delivered through humility. Because you are not able to do anything on your own, as the Lord says, without me ye can do nothing, let us ask the all-good and man-loving God with compunction and humility, with sighs and tears, to deliver us from demonic pride. Let us sigh like a publican, cry like the adulteress, repent like the prodigal son, saying, O all-good, compassionate, and man-loving Father, we have sinned before you. Accept our repentance and make us as one of your paid servants. Let us pray and beseech the Lord as the divine Chrysostom did in his daily prayers. O Lord, grant us humility, a humble way of thought and obedience. O Lord, grant us patience, long-suffering, and meekness. O Lord, implant in our heart the root of good, your fear. O Lord, grant us to love you with all our soul and heart and to keep your divine commandments. That's from his prayer according to the hours of the day. It's in our prayer book. Awesome prayer. It's one of my favorites. Because it's the hours of the day, there's 24 hours, and so there's 24 statements that begin with the word, O Lord. It's really beautiful. Likewise, so that we may be delivered from satanic and all destructive pride, let us look to the example of our heavenly teacher and to the lesson he gave to his disciples, to us and to all Christians of every generation and age. Learn from me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest in your souls. And when ye shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants, we have done that only which is our duty to do. Pretty beautiful little selection from St. Nicodius. And it's a great short explanation of what the Orthodox ascetic life is. This is what we do. We find the passions within us, and we seek to uproot them by practicing the corresponding virtue. I'll tell you, when I first read this was quite a few years ago, it was actually a little bit disheartening because I realized, I always hoped that there was a magic pill. What's that one prayer I can say? What's that one thing I can do? And suddenly all my passions will go away and it'll all become righteous. Nope, you have to do the work. You have to do the work. But it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile. So these are the virtues that we seek to obtain by overcoming the passions. We talked about St. John Cassian's 8 principal passions. Taking these passions is really, it's important to understand this, because if I'm going to give you anything from my life, I have to be in the process of striving for those virtues. If I don't have the virtue, I can't give you the virtue. And this is why, as an example, I can tell you how to pray. I can talk about it for hours and hours and hours. But the best way to learn how to pray is to spend time around those who really pray. I had a spiritual father once who, literally just standing next to him, before I had exchanged a word, I met him. I hadn't even met him yet. Actually, I was waiting to meet him. And I was standing next to him as he talked to somebody else. And I went, oh my goodness, this is a man of prayer. You could feel it just being in his presence. And through that, it really taught me how to pray. You want to learn humility? Find somebody who's really humble and learn from them face to face. We can only give what we have, and you cannot give what you don't have. Which is why if we want to change the world around us, the first thing we do is aim for our own hearts. You change your own heart first. This is why political means aren't the way to change everything. Does it mean that we ignore politics altogether? No. No. It's important to be involved somewhat in those and to have some influence on society. But we will have far more influence if we are living humble and loving lives and lives of prayer. It's the most important thing. So when we see passions within ourselves, we fight them. Tooth and nail, we have a bloody struggle to get rid of them. Today's mass movements and these passions, do they fight against them? No. They embrace them and they encourage most of them. So let's just look at a few. When did this mass movement really gain speed in this country? What was the first big, the atomic bomb of these movements? The 1960s. The 1960s and the sexual revolution. Did they want to fight fornication through self-control? No. They believe in free love. Go be with whoever you want, whenever you want, over and over and over again. Doesn't matter. And this will be a beautiful thing. They push for sexual promiscuity. What about avarice? Greed. Do we fight against greed? No, in fact, greed is the basis of our resentment for the fact that other people have more. It's not fair that they have more. And we're going to fight society and fight the systems that continue this process until we get what we want, whether we worked for it or not. And I thought it was one of the funniest things in the world during the Occupy Wall Street movements. Do you remember a famous figure who died then? Remember who it was? Steve Jobs. And so one of the ways to show that we really missed Steve Jobs was people would hold up iPads and iPhones with a vigil candle on it. And so there's the Occupy Wall Street movement where we're poor and downtrodden because you have all the money, and then they all held up their iPads and phones. And no one thought that was ironic. Like, again, 100 years ago, that would have been a magical device. And we all have it, but it's not fair for some reason. We're living it poor blood. It didn't make a lot of sense. What about anger? Do we fight against anger with this mass movement today? Absolutely not. In fact, anger is a good thing. It's called righteous indignation. The more angry you are, the more righteous you are. And we should listen to you. The more emotional you get, the more you must be really feeling it, and your voice is legitimized because you're angry. What about sorrow and despair? You can say they're trying to fight against this, but remember what we talked about last week. You are the movement. So any loss is absolutely devastating. I'll tell you, if you think a political loss is devastating to yourself, you're too involved. You're too involved in this world. You have too much love for this world. Vainglory. Do they seek to fight against the constant praise of others? No, in fact, kids are encouraged. I mean, everyone's encouraged to what you call virtue signaling. George Floyd died. We think it's bad, and it's not enough for me to think it's bad. I need to post it on social media and let everybody know that I think it's bad so you can see just how compassionate I am. It's really important. Everyone needs to know how compassionate I am. And this has gone so to such extreme extents that kids today will come out as transgender or gay or all these different things online, even if they're really not, because they just want the attention, they want the praise. It's kind of the strangest. It was the strangest thing in the world to me when Bruce Jenner received that award from ESPN, not for sports, but for being transgender. And everyone was clapping, and the commentary was, look how brave he is. And I thought, well, wait a minute, how brave do you have to be to go say something and everyone applauds you? And if anyone doesn't applaud loud enough, they get attacked. Like, that's bravery today? Apparently that's bravery today. And let's look at pride. Do they fight against pride? Absolutely not. There's a self-righteousness, which we'll talk about in a second, and there's something called the cancel culture. You take this idea of virtue signaling, and if somebody does something that you think is wrong, even years and years ago, you cancel them. You need to get them off social media. If they have a television show, you cancel that television show. If they have a movie, we're not even going to show Kindergarten Cop anymore. Because I'm so great, and look how virtuous I am, and you're completely wrong in everything you do and believe, and a lot of pride. So what's that line I always say? You cannot add sin to sin and expect peace to result. You can't look at what you perceive to be injustices in the country and then say, well, I'm going to add fornication, avarice, anger, sorrow, vainglory, and pride to the situation, and things will get better. It doesn't work that way, because you give what you have inside of you. The movement encourages these things. So if these aren't the virtues we're striving for, we're not striving for inner peace. We're not striving for humility. What are we striving for? I picked out seven virtues, main virtues that you can find in today's movements. Seven virtues. The first virtue is victimhood. Victimhood is the number one virtue of the mass movement today. Why? Because of what we just talked about. It's based in Marxism. There's the oppressed and the oppressors. If you're part of the oppressed, you're the bad guy. So you need to make yourself somehow... If you're part of the oppressors, you're the bad guy. So you need to make somehow yourself part of the oppressed. And you need to point out all the ways that you're part of the oppressed. And so there's whole entire philosophical theories of this. There's one called intersectionality. Have you heard of that? Intersectionality says, if I'm a lesbian black woman, my blackness doesn't describe me enough. You need to look at all these different facets about how I'm a victim of society and see how they intersect with each other to make me the greatest victim of all times. That's a little bit of a parody of it, but that's basically what it is. The more of a victim you are, the more legitimate your voice is. In fact, people vie to be victims. They want to be victims. So that if you question their narrative, they could say something that's a lie. Who is the guy in Chicago we had, the actor from the show Empire? Jesse Smollett. We know for a fact that he lied about what happened to him. He said that some guys came and called him a bunch of horrible things and put a noose around his neck and said, "This is MAGA country," and beat him up. And he went home, and for some reason he kept the noose on him even while he called the police, and they came and they're like, "What's this guy doing?" It was very strange. And they found out he'd made the whole thing up. There are those today who still claim that he was a victim, even though we know that it didn't actually happen. His voice is legitimate because he's black. And so he needs to retain that victim status, even if it was a lie. And success stories are seen as betrayals of the cause. Thomas Sowell talks about this. He says, if you end up taking personal responsibility for... He's a black man, by the way. He says, if you as a black man take personal responsibility and find success, you are told you're acting white and you're an Uncle Tom and you've betrayed the cause. Unless you continue to push the ideological narrative from your new position of power. That's the only way you get out of that. Victimhood believes in emotionality over facts. If I can weep over what a victim I am, it doesn't matter if my story is true or not. It doesn't matter if I'm reading somebody's... I mean, a lot of times people will read say, "Oh, you did that because you're racist." Well, maybe that wasn't the reason. It doesn't matter. The fact that I'm emotionally upset about it, you need to accept that as truth. That's my truth is more important than the truth. And there's no sense of personal responsibility. So victimhood was our number one virtue. Number two, self-righteousness and moral superiority. We talked about the call-out culture and the cancel culture. You need to call it. This happens on college campuses. If your professor says something, even if he clearly didn't mean it in a negative way, if you can twist it so that it looks like he was speaking out against the leftist ideology, if you can twist it so that it looks like he was not being inclusive and wasn't pushing the idea, you can call him out, call the administration, and sometimes even get him fired. And yes, this happens. There's another book Jonathan Haidt wrote with a guy named, I forget his first name, but Luke Yanoff, I think, was the last name. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. And it talks a lot about what's happening on college campus and how somebody can send an email that looks perfectly innocent, but if somebody can find something in it that is somehow offensive, they call that out and suddenly there's calls for this person to be fired, even though you had to look for it and you had to really read into it. Call-out culture, self-righteousness, moral superiority. You condemn all who disagree as racist, homophobes, bigots, all these different things we hear all the time. If you don't accept the fullness of my movement, it's because you're racist. That's really the only reason. And there's a joy out of exposing the faults of others. You get excited to do so, even to the point of ruining their lives. And many lives have been ruined with this call-out culture. You call somebody out for a tweet they did when they were like 12 years old, and you destroy their lives. They lose their job, which means their family's hurting as well. Their name's out there publicly, and so it's hard for them to find another job. And sometimes you'll even dox them, which means not just releasing their name, but sometimes their address, so they get physically harassed. And that's seen as, "I did a good thing here." Because that person was racist, they're just increasing the racism of our country, and so by calling them out and destroying their life, I'm actually doing something good for everybody else. So it's a net gain. That's the belief. Number three, another virtue of the movement today, bitterness and resentment. No gratitude is allowed, like we talked about. You're not allowed to have any gratitude for what the country has done. Anger is seen as righteous. It's never questioned. If you're angry, then your truth is what matters. Not the truth. And you're seen as a justice warrior. The more angry you are, the more bitter you are, the more of a warrior you are, and we should admire you for that. We should absolutely admire you. I said that with a little bit of an accent. Admire you. We should admire you for that, right? It's really important. That person, wow, look at how righteously indignant they are. Look at how angry they are. They must have really gone through some things, and they're really fighting for the cause. They really believe it. Number four. A virtue of never forgiving. You never forgive your ideological opponents. You can forgive those who are fighting for your cause. Right? You can do that, which is why there's this constant double standard. Okay? So, not to get into politics today, but I'll do it anyway. It's kind of ironic that the ticket that's really pushing this ideology, the Biden and Harris ticket, look at some of Biden's past statements. Had a conservative said those things, there would have been mob attacks against him right away. I don't know if you know some of the things that Biden has said. You know, he praised Obama as, you know, he's articulate and he's clean. which is not something you want to say about a black person. That was, you know, it's kind of strange. He said you can't walk into a 7-Eleven without hearing a slight Indian accent. You know, if you vote for the Republicans, they'll put you all back in chains. If you don't know who to vote for, me or Trump, then you ain't black. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that would have just ended his candidacy a long time ago if he had the wrong ideology. But because he has the right ideology, that's just Joe being Joe, and we can forgive it. Kamala Harris has an interesting family history. I won't get into that, but if you look into that, it's kind of interesting. We're really worried about people's families here who owned slaves many generations ago, but wasn't that long ago for her family. So this is not to focus in on this current election. It's just simply to say there's no forgiveness for those who don't push the ideology. But if you push the ideology enough, maybe we can forgive you and give you a little bit of leeway. That's why there's a lot of double standards. People shut you down for things that were said or written years, even decades ago. Makes you feel a lot more self-righteous. The person can say, whoa, I forgot I even wrote that. That was when I was like a teenager. It was dumb. I totally regret it. Doesn't matter. You're gone. No forgiveness is allowed. And that's why, because the country once had slavery, it doesn't matter that we don't have it anymore. It once had Jim Crow laws. It doesn't matter that we don't anymore. It's ingrained in the country, and therefore, what are we really looking for? Destruction. Destroy it. Tear it all down. There's no redemption ever. You cannot be redeemed. You cannot be redeemed, so we need to tear it down. Number five virtue, dichotomous thinking. Everything is yes or no. This is the ideological purity we were talking about last week. There's no nuance. There's no gratitude. Everything's black or white. It's yes or no. We need safe spaces because we can't allow anything from the other side to get in. We can't even have the conversation, which is why we need to silence anybody who disagrees with us, even in a little way. You need to silence them. Number six, the virtue of propaganda and forcibly overtaking segments of society to become tools of the ideology. This is why this ideology, have you noticed, it infects everything. This ideology is found in Hollywood with movies. It's found in television. It's found in music all over the place. It's found in news. The vast majority of news, it runs this ideology. It's found, oddly enough, in sports, right? The NFL and NBA, you see the stuff happening with them. The ideology is changing the way they do things. It's definitely found in universities. It's found in psychology. We'll talk about that when we get to one of the later lectures. But a lot of the stuff that's pushed in psychology today isn't based in science. It isn't based in tests, it's based in ideology. It's found in medicine. I think I talked about last week the endocrinologist who told me that most of his fellow endocrinologists agree with him about what he believes about injecting hormones into young kids for transgenderism. But most of them refuse to speak up because they know if they speak up, they will be cut out. They're terrified. It infects everything. Did you hear the one from this past week? Teachers in public schools who are still doing Zoom sessions are terrified that parents may be somewhere unseen behind the screen listening to what they're saying. So I think it was in Tennessee, they're making them sign a paper that says, I won't be in the room when you're teaching my children. This is crazy. They're literally afraid because they want to be able to indoctrinate without having any pushback. And absolutely shutting down opposing voices. Debate is no longer necessary. We just shut it down. If you have a conservative speaker coming to campus, what do? You try to shut it down by force and violence. A lot of videos on YouTube if you don't believe me about that. Look at Ben Shapiro in Berkeley and see what happened there. Finally, number seven, justice. We are going to go over today, forgive me. We're going to keep going. Justice is about intentions, not results. We're fighting for justice right now, right? We're fighting for justice. That's what these riots are about. What did we talk about last week? 18 or more dead, depending on how you count them, 900 officer casualties, 14,000 arrests, and $600 million in property damage. Last week, I might have said billion by accident. Million. $600 million worth of property damage. Is that all okay? Of course it is, because we have the intent of bringing more justice, and what you're not. You're actually ruining people's lives. But no. But if you disagree with us, you're racist. So we're trying to end racism, so we keep going with this. All this, by the way, all those things I just listed, the 18 or more dead, 900 officer casualties, $600 million in property damage, 14,000 arrests, it's all in response to systemic police brutality and racism, which ironically, the statistics show doesn't exist. I don't know if you know about this, but there is a black Harvard professor who sought to prove through the statistics. He wanted to prove that systemic police racism does indeed exist. And so he did a study, and his study did what? It disproved it. He was shocked to see the results. His studies disproved systemic police racism. He found it doesn't exist based on the statistics. Does that mean that an individual officer can't do wrong things or be racist? Of course an individual, but on a systemic level, it doesn't exist. So why riot? Why riot cause all this destruction? Because it continues to push the ideology along. So what is social justice? Thomas Sowell notes that if social justice were, if the causes were effective, then we would be immoral not to support the social justice movement. But, he writes this, he says, what social justice seeks to do is to eliminate undeserved disadvantages for selected groups. However, in its pursuit of justice for a segment of society, it in disregard of the consequences for society as a whole, what is called social justice might more accurately be called anti-social justice, since what consistently gets ignored and dismissed are precisely the costs to society. So that's a mouthful. Thomas Sowell writes that way. One of the examples he gives happened, I think, in Oakland or San Francisco. I don't remember. Somebody called to order a pizza. Pizza company said, I'm sorry, we don't deliver to that neighborhood. Person in the neighborhood said, well, wait a minute. You deliver to another neighborhood that's just as far away as I am. This isn't fair. And made a big case out of it. And the city council came in and said, you have to deliver to that neighborhood. Do you know why that pizza company didn't deliver to that neighborhood? Because the rate of crime was so extraordinarily high, they had too many people, too many delivery guys, get assaulted or get mugged and have their things stolen. And so they stopped delivering to that neighborhood. Social justice says, well, that's not fair. And so we're going to put pizza delivery guys' lives at risk in order to be fair. That's what Thomas Sowell's talking about. He says we have a goal of fairness, but we disregard the consequences and the costs to society as a whole. Remember what I said, that seventh one. Justice is about intentions over results. I have a whole lot of quotes here from Thomas Sowell. I'm not going to read them all because we just don't have the time. But I'll tell you another one that he talks about. He talks about, because so much of this is focused on minorities, again, it's the oppressed and the oppressors. And so much of this is focused on black families. And he talks about this. He says, 100 years ago, when blacks were just one generation out of slavery, the rate of marriage in the black population in the United States was slightly higher than that of the white population. Most black children were raised in two-parent families, even during the era of slavery, and for generations thereafter. The catastrophic decline of the black nuclear family began, like so many other social catastrophes in the United States, during the decade of the 1960s. Prior to the 1960s, the difference in marriage rates between black and white males was never as great as 5 percentage points. Yet today, that difference is greater than 20 percentage points. He wrote this quite a few years ago. And widening, even though the nuclear family is also beginning to decline among white Americans. Whatever the explanation for these changes, it lies much closer, the explanation does, to today than to the era of slavery. In other words, if you look at the chronology, the problems it's gotten worse closer to today than it was when you get closer to slavery in time. However disappointing that may be to those who prefer to see social issues as moral melodramas. Keep in mind, this is a black economist speaking. He also talks about what happened to income in black families and how that also began to go down after the 1960s. What happened in the 1960s? You had what was called the War on Poverty. So the War on Poverty happens, and what happens is poverty, instead of going down, goes up. And seeking to help black families, it actually makes black families worse off. And so what do we do? Of course, as a country, we said, well, wait a minute, these don't seem to be working out, so let's rethink these things and undo them because we really need to help. No! You're told if you're against the war on poverty, then you must be pro-poverty, which is why politicians always give these things snappy names. You know, end bad thing, Bill 101. Like, that's what they're always called. So we never actually re-examine these things, and we continue doing it even though the results are bad. Why? Because the intentions are what matter. It doesn't matter what's happening actually around the world in real terms. Look at today, one of the examples given always. Look at the places where the left has been in control the longest and has the deepest power, where you couldn't find a conservative if you wanted to. Look at these cities, Detroit, LA, San Francisco, and what do you find? Do you find minorities doing better or worse there? Worse. Again and again and again, you find it worse. So you think, well, wait a minute, we should take a step back and maybe reconsider the policies here. But we don't do that because why? The intentions matter because the intentions help push the ideology. Now, admittedly, you can look at this and say, Father, why are you getting so political with this stuff? Why are you getting so political? Because this is the basis of what's happening around us right now. We need to understand what they value to see that when the results don't work out, it doesn't matter because the virtues are still being pushed. The self-righteousness is still there. This pride in thinking that I can change the world and the help that people need relies on me and what I do. It's still there. This idea of anger at anyone who disagrees with you is still there. These virtues are being pushed because the ideology is pushed. We need to understand this. I'm sorry if people don't like it, but this is just what's happening around us. Am I telling you that you need to go vote for Trump? No. Right now you have three options. Don't vote, vote for Trump, or vote for a third party. But I don't know how you can vote for the Democratic Party today and be an Orthodox Christian. And I don't care if that sounds controversial, it shouldn't be. When they're promoting the anti-family LGBT movement, when they believe in not only the continuation of abortion, but now in infanticide. If you're going to abort a baby and it's born alive, they believe you should just let it die. A breathing, living human being right there in front of you, let it die. I don't know how, I don't care how many of their other policies you like. I don't care. It's the strangest thing to me. It's like saying, no, Hitler's got a lot of great economic policies. I don't like that he wants to imprison and kill the Jews. But I'm not going to be a one-issue voter. His economic plan, his national plan is really good, so we're going to go for that. And of course not. Of course not. Transgenderism, when we talk about that one, talk about an evil movement. They know for a fact that people who are pushing this movement have a higher chance of suicide. The suicidality rate goes way up. And they quote a couple studies to say that it doesn't. Those studies are ridiculous when you actually look at the inward workings of them. They look at people over the course of 1 year. And they say, oh, after that year, these people aren't more suicidal. But the ones that have longevity to them find out, whoa, suicide rates go way up. And they're doing this to children, not knowing what the injection of hormones will do to them, not knowing what the long-term psychological effects will be. They're doing this for children who have had psychological evaluations that lasted for one session for half an hour. That's sick. I don't care how many other ideas that you support from them. You cannot vote for that. You simply cannot vote for that. So you have three other options that I just gave you. Thomas Sowell writes, with justice, as with equality, the question is not whether more is better, but whether it is better at all costs. What are the costs of what we're pushing? What will happen to society? We need to consider what those who believe in the vision of cosmic justice, what he calls it, seldom want to consider, the nature of those costs and how they change the very nature of justice itself. There's a whole lot I want to quote from him, but we're running out of time. The idea behind this is that it doesn't really matter with the anointed vision, as we keep pushing, it doesn't really matter what happens. It doesn't matter what the destructive effects are. It's the good intentions of these people who are so righteous, they're much more righteous than us. That's what matters most. And it doesn't matter that their intentions actually end up harming both those they seek to help and the rest of society. It doesn't matter. The intention is what's most important. If you reject their plans, it must be because you actually like the injustices of society, right? That's what we hear all the time out of Congress. If you don't support this bill helping elderly people, you must want to harm elderly people. Well, wait a minute. I actually think this bill is going to harm them in the end. Well, it's right there in the name. Help the elderly people, Bill 101. We have this all the time. The real movement for social justice, what really happens with the anointed, with these leftist mass movements, is that they want to change human behavior. They want to change the way the world works. And that means changing everything, which is why that whole list we gave, NFL, sports, TV, everything has to be politicized. Everything has to be politicized because you have to change the way the world works in order to push forth this vision. Nothing can stand in the way, which is why Marxism killed anybody who didn't have a perfectly pure vision of Marxism. And if this works out poorly for you, well, that's only because you're part of the oppressor class. So too bad for you. You deserve it. What's the opposing view? The Guardians, what do they believe in? Everything is trade-offs. Everything in life, when we talk about economics, when we talk about social justice, it's all trade-offs. And people work those trade-offs best when they have a purpose within themselves. B, they have compassion, which is brought about by that moral and religious life that we live. And number three, they believe in personal responsibility. If we have those things, if we have purpose, compassion, and personal and a belief in personal responsibility, then we look at any situation and go, there is no perfect solution. That's what the Guardians believe. There is no perfect solution. We didn't try to make a perfect country. If we had a perfect country, we wouldn't need protections. Rather, we just want to care for ourselves, our families, and one another as best we can. And the laws of the country are just to make sure that that keeps us doing the best we can. In other words, let me explain it this way. Let's look at the issue of poverty. Christian faith sees poverty not as something to cure. We don't seek to fix poverty so that it doesn't exist. Because in order to do that, there's a lot of factors that go in. What are the costs if we try to do that? It's a lot of cost to society. And can you do that with somebody who doesn't want it to be fixed? What if somebody's in poverty and they don't want it to be fixed? You can't do that. So rather than trying to fix poverty, we don't even look at this idea of people in poverty as a mass thing. What do I mean by that? There's no people in poverty in our minds. Rather, there's only the poor person next to you. That's what we deal with. We deal with the poor person next to us rather than this idea of poor people around the country. You deal with poor people around the country, you have to have a massive nationwide solution to it. And does a nationwide solution work for every person? No. So what you do is you talk to the person right next to you. Can you imagine if everybody just took care of the person right next to them? We wouldn't need national policies, which is why a moral and religious people is what we need. We wouldn't need to change society. You just help the person next to you. And the poor person would benefit from your love, and you would benefit from offering charity in the first place. Everybody wins. Because salvation is closer to all. Salvation is closer to all. So this is about changing society versus changing ourselves. The Christian looks at the sin in the world and says, this is my fault, and I need to change myself. The social justice warrior, the Marxist ideologue, says, no, the only reason I'm unhappy is it's everybody else's fault, so we need to change everybody else. That's the goal. The anointed believe that if we aren't perfect, it's somebody else's fault. And if we can't fix that system, we'll burn it down. That's what's happening around us right now. This is why the left-right divide, I think, is ridiculous, like I said. I don't think it's just a matter of opinion. It's a matter of worldview. It's a matter of worldview and what will work and what consequences those worldviews will have. So, again, forgive me if some of that sounded a little bit too political, but the reality is that politics infects everything right now. And does it infect faiths? Absolutely. Are they trying to make sure that you are no longer a tax-exempt organization as a church if you don't do gay marriage? Yes, they're trying to push that right now. They're trying to push that right now. They're trying to take away churches' tax-exempt statuses. Do they believe in attacking churches? They don't know much about us, so we've been relatively safe. But Catholic churches have not been safe. Many of them have been vandalized. I'll tell you, the only reason we weren't vandalized is because a few of us were standing outside watching. I guarantee it. There's somebody in our parish who saw somebody walk up to the church with a spray paint can. And they said, no, and the person ran away. It's the only reason. So, what do we do with all this? Let me look back at my notes here and make sure we covered all those things. I know it was a lot. And like I said, I ran through, there's a lot more explanation for each of those things, but we need to talk really quickly just about the role of faith in the movement. You notice that if you keep doing something over and over again, and it doesn't work, but you say, no, it's going to work this next time, what does that take? Faith. Faith in the idea. So, one of the things you'll constantly hear, and it's almost impossible to break through this, this shows that somebody has become subject to ideology. Marxism has failed every time it's been tried. It has caused the murder of millions. It is not a good economic system. it fails. Wait a minute. That's only because it hasn't been tried right yet. How do you know that? You have faith. Remember last week we said you cannot escape faith? You cannot escape faith. You have faith in something no matter what. You can't escape it. We have faith in God, who certainly is involved in this world, but isn't going to make this world paradise because he wants us to yearn for the next life. This world is too full of sin, and it's full of death and corruption. We don't have faith in this world. We have faith in the next. We're citizens of the next life. So to end, what do we do with this? The reason we're doing this talk is so that I can do the research for you. I don't want you heavily involved in this stuff. Father Justin, I've been telling you during coronavirus, turn off the news. Stop looking into all the different theories about what's really happening. Don't get too involved in politics. Turn off the radio. You don't need to read all about this. Now you may say, well, Father, you're giving us book recommendations. Yes. I'm saying if you want to get a foundational understanding of what's happening around you, go ahead and read these books. But after that, go back and pray. You want to know what's going to benefit you? Prayer, fasting, church services, scriptures, prostrations, and worrying about the person next to you. That's what will benefit you. If you get too heavily involved in this, you start to over-intellectualize everything. And then you start to believe that you understand this better than everybody around you. And what does that lead to? Pride, which means pride is the chief passion, so you're actually doing the exact opposite for yourself than the church is supposed to do in the first place. I've seen this. It happened to me when I first became Orthodox. I was Mr. Super Orthodox, and I understood everything. I had to be slammed down by a couple of spiritual fathers who really humbled me, and it was really good for me, and I thank God for them. You have to be able to look at this stuff dispassionately, and you need to be able to step away from it. So get out of the intellectual stuff and get into your heart. We had somebody during this whole coronavirus thing who said, they said, I was really upset at first about the whole thing, but finally, a few weeks in, I decided just to pray with my family and actually create a spiritual rhythm. And my prayer life has never been better. And I finally get it. I get why this is so important. The same thing happened, we talked about in the Romanian prisons under communism. Remember we talked about the Legionnaires? In the Legionnaire movement were all these people who are like super Orthodox, but one side believed we got to fight the communists tooth and nail, we got to formulate arguments against them, we got to argue with them face to face. The other side said, we're imprisoned, let's make the best of this and just really delve deep into asceticism, prayer and fasting, forced fasting. And the guys who were in the first camp, little by little, started joining the second camp, and they said, this is the right path. This path brings you peace. The first one doesn't. Delving too far into this stuff won't bring you peace. So, do it in a limited fashion, based on what I'm giving you, but I'm doing this so you don't have to. So don't delve too much into this. Rather, live the spiritual life as much as possible. Now, today and 1 week ago, we're all about giving the foundation so you can begin to understand better about what's happening in the world around us. I gave you the information I wanted to give you. Like I said, I could have kept talking for a couple more hours and given you more explanation. But for the most part, I gave you what I wanted. I gave you what I think you need. I don't think you need much beyond that. I really don't think you need much beyond that. I think what we really need to do is take this and say, how do we live as Orthodox Christians in this world that's falling apart? So next week was supposed to be a talk called Monasticism in the World. Basically, how do we live as ascetics? How do we be in but not of the world, especially in this situation? However, there's going to be a change of plan. Father Justin can't be here next week. And that was his talk to give. Mine was the next one. And it's basically, how do we talk about the faith and how do we not talk about the faith with others? So we're going to go through a lot of different situations. We're going to talk about what happens if your work is part of this movement and wants you to march in the Pride Parade. What happens if you have family members who just don't get this? You know, what if somebody wants to talk to you and they say, well, what is Orthodoxy? Why don't you accept this? How do you talk to people in those situations? When do you open your mouth? When do you keep your mouth shut? When is it a good cause? When is it a lost cause? That everything next week is going to be very practical and focused on those things. All this really heady stuff, I realize some of it's tough to take in. All that stuff is foundation. We've laid it. Boom, we're done. From now on, it's going to be very, very practical stuff. And we'll talk in later lectures about specific issues that you see around us and how to specifically talk about those. I'll give you the facts and things. So, I'll do the research for you. But we're going to get to really practical stuff. So if you have questions about that and you want to email me this next week so you make sure I include it in the lecture, feel free to. Otherwise, I have a whole lot of things to already talk about. Okay, very last thing before we get to a few questions. I told you three more books. I told you last week that Thomas Sowell's Conflict of Visions, one of the ones that I recommended last week, is part of an unofficial trilogy. He wrote two other books that go really well with this. But this one's a balanced look at kind of conservative, liberal, left and right, and what are the underlying beliefs. That's what this is. So this is pretty unbiased. He gets pretty biased in the other ones. The other ones are The Vision of the Anointed. That's where I got that term. Also by Thomas Sowell. Really good book that explains kind of the underpinnings of the ideology. And then he wrote one that I think is a little bit more accessible. I read some quotes from it tonight. It can still be tough, but it's a little bit more succinct. And it's called The Quest for Cosmic Justice. Those three books make up that trilogy. If you were only to read one of them and you wanted to find out more about kind of what's happening around us, I'd probably read this last one, The Quest for Cosmic Justice. I said some things that might have surprised you about liberal democracy. If you want to read about that, I've read through a lot of this, not the whole thing. It's been very good. In every one of these books, I could tell you I don't agree 100%. That's okay. But the overarching view I agree with, and this one's been very interesting. It's by some guy whose name I can't pronounce, Rizard Legutko. I think the last name is spelled, I'll just say it's L-E-G-U-T-K-O. Somebody who first grew up in the Soviet Union, and then came to America. And he realized, liberal democracy has a lot of similarities with what I just left. Solzhenitsyn said the same thing, by the way. It's called The Demon in Democracy. It's been excellent so far. I've really learned a lot from this, and it's been very eye-opening. So this is kind of about how liberal democracy tends towards the same things, especially if we become secularized. So those are the three books. And the last name is Legutko, L-E-G-U-T-K-O. Okay, The Demon in Democracy. So forgive me for going over. I went 20 minutes over that I wanted to. I'm sorry, but like I said, I had to cut out a lot, so please forgive me.